Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Mythgard Academy. This is session number 20, Until We Have Faces. And today, we should be getting close to the end of the penultimate chapter of the book. That is the third chapter of part two. I don't know if we'll get all the way to the end of chapter three, but we might. That's kind of my unofficial goal. But as I've said before, I'm not apologizing for however long the end of this book takes us. We shall be finished with this book when we are finished with this book. We are coming towards what I've been so excited about. I've said before, I find the ending of this book deeply moving and just gorgeous and brilliant. But I'm not sure I've still ever in my life fully understood it. So I am so looking forward to the opportunity to work it through with you guys carefully and really continue the work that we've been doing of making all of these rich connections that Lewis invites us to make as we come towards the end. yes. Well, JJ, we'll finish with the book eventually, but this is a book that might not finish with you right away, I guess what I would say about that. At least that's been my experience of it. We were just about to get to, I think that tonight we will get through, the last two sort of visions that Orawal has of her own tribulations. We had the one which she wasn't sure whether it was a vision, like whether it was a dream or whether it actually happened, about her going down to the river and trying to drown herself, but then being told by the god not to. And we had the one where she dreamed that she was an ant, hauling huge things around. And we were just about up to her dream of the rams, which is just about what we'll start with here tonight. So let's dive straight in here. Okay, this is the last slide we talked about last time, and I wanted to remember this because it's very important to the vision of the rams, which follows right after this. So you'll remember that her response to realizing that she was Ungit, right? When she has fully acknowledged and embraced this idea that she herself has been Ungit, and that she is the one who is this like horrible, devouring thing, right? She tries to fix it, right? She resolves to be a better philosopher. She sort of tried to follow the way of the fox, right? And she was, resolved to live better and to be better, that even if her body were ugly, she could make her soul beautiful. And she, of course, experienced significant frustration with that, right? And of course, that's where we start here. She ended the paragraph describing her determination to do better and to be better, by saying, with the gods helping, she'd be able to do it. The gods helping, but would they help? Nevertheless, I must begin, and it seemed to me that they would not help. I would set out boldly each morning to be just and calm and wise in all my thoughts and acts, but before they had finished dressing me, I would find that I was back, and knew not how long I had been back, in some old rage, resentment, gnawing fantasy, or sullen bitterness. I could not hold out half an hour. And a horrible memory crept into my mind of those days when I had tried to mend the ugliness of my body with new devices in the way I did my hair or the colors I wore. I had a cold fear that I was at the same work again. I could mend my soul no more than my face, unless the gods helped. And why did the gods not help? Bye-bye! A terrible, sheer thought, huge as a cliff, towered up before me, infinitely likely to be true. No man will love you, though you gave your life for him, unless you have a pretty face. So, might it not be? The gods will not love you, however you try to pleasure them, and whatever you suffer, unless you have that beauty of soul. In either race, for the love of men or the love of a god, The winners and losers are marked out from birth. We bring our ugliness in both kinds with us into the world, with it our destiny. How bitter this was. Every ill-favored woman will know. We have all had our dream of some other land, some other world, some other way of giving the prizes which would bring us in as the conquerors, leave the smooth, rounded limbs and the little pink and white faces and the hair like burnished gold far behind. Their day ended and ours come. But how if it's not so at all? How if we were made to be dregs and refuse everywhere and every way? So she finds she can't make herself more beautiful by her own efforts. She tries, right, through resolution and philosophy, to give herself a more beautiful soul, to stop being Ungot. Remember, it was to stop being Ungot that she was wanting to kill herself first, right? That was how she characterized it. When she went down to the river and with the plan to drown herself, she was trying to stop being Ungot. And remember, it was even, she even characterized it by saying, you know, that way of stopping to be Ungot was not available to her. Right. So she wants to stop being Ungot. So her second plan, right, self-destruction is her first plan. Her second plan is to make, to stop being Ungot, right, to be prettier instead, to beautify her soul. And she finds that she can't do it unless the gods helped. And why did the gods not help? And this is what, of course, leads her to believe, to this horrible thought, which causes her to explain with a kind of spontaneity. Again, we've never seen the narrator say bye-bye at the beginning of a paragraph, right? With the fox's old expression of, you know, amazement and horror, right? But this thought leads her to that. And the thought is that the gods just, there are some people. Maybe she is destined to be Ungot in her soul, in the same way that she was destined to be ugly. She was given a face that caused all men to reject her. And she didn't do anything to deserve that. Right? She didn't do anything to make herself ugly. She was just born that way. And has been dealing her entire life with the fact that she is physically repulsive. And therefore cut off from most of what, you know, women are supposed to do and be in her society. Especially daughters of kings. Right? Notice, by the way, one is tempted to sort of point to a thing that she seems to be overlooking here, right? On the one hand, you can say things like the sentence I just said, right? That she, because she was born ugly, has, you know, missed out on the opportunity to do and to be what women are supposed to be. You know, to fulfill the role of women in her society, and especially the role of the daughter of a king, right? And yet, this is Orawal we're talking about. This is Orawal, the great queen. On the other hand, to look at Orawal's life and say, what a tragic waste, is absurd. What she's done and what she's accomplished, right? I mean, it's that anybody could look at Orawal's life and say, wow, it's just too bad she never, you know, had any opportunities. It's just too bad that she accomplished so little with her life, right? I mean, she's become literally like a mythic figure in her own lifetime, in large part because of what she has accomplished, right? And of course, she herself never thinks about this. And by pointing this out, I'm not, of course, trying to diminish the grief and the trauma that she has obviously experienced from the rejection, which had sort of focused in her father, right? But also, even notice the implicit reference to Bardia here. No man will love you though you gave your life for him unless you have a pretty face. She never stood a chance. Her versus Ansett, right? Again, it's not fair. He'd already met Ansett, and he couldn't have married her anyway because she's daughter of a king and he's not, and you know, whatever. But still, you can feel that grief there, right? It comes to, you know, Bardia is kind of implicated in some sense here as well. And through him, you know, everybody else. And she realizes, no man will love you, though you gave your life. And what if the gods... What if it's the same way with the gods? Now, remember the thing that's kind of lurking behind this. There's an unacknowledged by her thing all the way through from the very beginning of the story of Psyche. Right? She and Psyche have always been opposites in this way. She's always been the goblin face. The one so ugly, nobody wanted anything to do with her. Well, except all the people who loved her. Right. Again, notice how easy it is to look at her life like completely one way or completely the other way. Like when you look at it one way and you're like, oh, the poor Orawal who has never been loved. Right. Because she's ugly and rejected. But then, of course, we remember Ansett saying... you know, that the queen has been very fortunate in her servants. Yes. Yes, Orawal's career has been marked by the fact that many wonderful people have loved her and devoted their lives to her. So she's not been exactly unloved, actually, in fact, right? But anyway, okay. Back to Psyche, though. Psyche was just blessed with all the good things. And when they were described back in the, you know, early chapters, like back in, like, what was it, chapter 3 or chapter 4 of book 1, in the original descriptions, we see Orwell's own, like, marveling at it, right? She is just, she is... just enamored of Psyche and Psyche's beauty. But it's clear that she perceives the fact that Psyche has all of these advantages that she doesn't have, where Orawal was born ugly, hideous. Psyche is born the most beautiful creature anyone had ever seen. And it's not just her physical beauty. She's also intelligent, and she's wise, and she's thoughtful, and she's cheerful, and she's happy. Right? She has all the good things that Orwell doesn't have. And then she goes off and gets married to the god. And is given the palace on the mountain, and right? Orawal herself never, ever acknowledged envy for Psyche. That she was jealous of Psyche. Or again, envious, technically. That she envied Psyche, her good fortune. That she compared herself with Psyche, that she felt herself to be in competition with Psyche. But there were several moments where we could detect that happening, right? And again, she never acknowledged it, but we could see it in places. I just wanted to remind us of that, because I think we have to hear that in this paragraph. I think if we're not hearing that in this paragraph, where when she talks about the smooth, rounded limbs, the little pink and white faces, the hair like burnished gold. Probably, Orawal is herself thinking of Redival, But it's Psyche also, right? And when she is here talking about herself, she's speaking as if she, on behalf of the ugly women, right? You know, all ill-favored women know this reality, she says, right? And on behalf of ill-favored women, she says, she speaks of the dream that they have of some other... Those who are born ugly are just doomed to never be appreciated like those who happen to be born pretty. But there's this dream that maybe there's another way of looking at things. Maybe there's another world in which they win and the pretty ones are the losers, right? And this final question, how if we were made to be dregs and refuse everywhere in every way, what would happen if you were destined to not only have an ugly face, but an ugly soul? But you notice also the flip side to that. The flip side to that also is an additional and a deeper layer of envy, because Psyche seems to have both. Psyche was given all the good things. Psyche was made incredibly beautiful and also blessed in soul. She could, as at the time, that is, at the time way back in book one when she was describing Psyche's childhood, she said almost boastfully how Psyche, you know, how virtuous Psyche was. You know, how good and just all the ways, right? All the way. She has a, clearly, has, her soul is as beautiful as her face, right? And of course, that just seemed like an awesome thing back then in book one. But now, confronted with this terrible sheer thought, huge as a cliff, towering up before her, now all of a sudden, there's that divide again. Remember that whole pattern, that whole trend of her and Psyche standing on different ground with a gulf in between them. And Psyche being so far above her that she can't reach, right? This, it seems to me, is another way of looking at that, which I think should very much inform our thoughts about, like, our understanding of what Orwell was herself feeling and experiencing. She wasn't thinking in these terms, right? But now, kind of having thought about it more, having understood it better, I think that she's now in some ways kind of equipped to understand those older feelings better. Now, so there are a couple things here. Curious Chance was pointing, so I need to respond to a couple comments here, because these are really important questions. Curious Chance says, it seems to me that she is avoiding any responsibility for the ugliness of her soul. I think it's a really perceptive comment, right? On the one hand, it does kind of get you off, doesn't it? Right? If you say, well, I was just born horrible, so guess I'll just be horrible, right? I mean, I don't necessarily agree that that's what Orwell is doing here, but you are absolutely right that that is a potential application of this line of thinking, right? The thing that I would remind us of, however, that I think is really relevant to this. Remember, this all comes out of the fact that she has been trying, like genuinely trying really hard to change her soul, right? So there's a sense in which she didn't start off with this as a premise and then use that as an excuse, right? Instead, she has tried to take responsibility for her soul and to do something about it. And it's her repeated failure to do that, to accomplish that, that has forced her to this conclusion. So it's not, again, I don't deny the logic and the significance of what you're pointing out, but that's not been kind of the trajectory that Orwell has shown here. But then Liz was saying, if ugly souls are like ugly bodies, there's nothing she can do, but also there's no fault in her. The fault is in those who fail to value her. And that is also true. Again, just as Liz, as we were suggesting, as I was suggesting before, there does seem to be a kind of indictment, right? Implicit in the statement, no man will love you though you gave your life for him unless you have a pretty face, right? That's not a criticism of the ugly woman. That's a criticism of the men, right? The problem here is not, part of the problem at least, is not the ugliness itself. It's the men, right? It's the shallowness of their judgment. It's, as you say, the fault of those who fail to value her and judge her simply on her face. So I think that that's true, Liz, but let's think for a second about how this relates to the gods and ugly souls, right? Because the parallel between men refusing to love a woman unless she has a pretty face and the gods refusing to, like, accept a mortal unless she has a beautiful soul, there's a flaw in the parallelism here, which she's not addressing exactly. She's not addressing it explicitly. And of course, the way in which those two situations are not parallel is that the men who are rejecting the ugly women are presumably not themselves causing the women to be ugly. Right? They didn't have anything to do with that. Right? The gods, her whole point is that the gods themselves are giving the prizes, right? The gods are the ones who are allocating beauty and ugliness here, both on the physical side and on the spiritual side. So, again, that's how the two things are not parallel, Liz. But I think that what you're pointing to, the thing that you're pointing at, is one of the things that really brings that difference to the surface here, right? At the end of the day, the indictment against the gods is not that they reject people with ugly... It would not be rejecting people with ugly souls. Again, you can say the men who reject the ugly women just for being ugly are shallow, and this is, like, they should value them more, you know, for other things other than just, like, a pretty face, right? Yes. But with the gods, the situation is different, right? With the gods, the issue is their acceptance. If the beauty of soul that they award is a mark of their favor, then it's given... It's not that it's dependent upon the beauty of soul. It's that the beauty of soul is dependent on it, right? It goes the other direction. And that's the problem. How if we were made to be dregs and refuse everywhere in every way? What if we are predestined to be rejected? We've already been rejected and there's nothing we can do about it. That's the horrible, the terrible sheer thought, huge as a cliff, that towers up before her and seems infinitely likely to be true. Well, Curious Chance, it is true. The question is whether the gods have a right to reject an ugly soul or an obligation to do so. Yes, but the problem is, but what if they've made the soul? I mean, she describes ugly and beautiness as just like a quality that is bestowed upon the people. That's the terrible sheer thought that she's imagining. What if, because remember, this all is a result of her attempting to beautify her soul and finding that it's useless, that she can't do it, that the gods won't help her do it. And then she's like, oh, bye-bye. Of course they won't help. They made me this way in the first place. This was their choice to make me Ungit. So of course I can't stop being Ungit. They decided I should be Ungit, just like they decided I should be ugly. And thus they've decided that I was made to be dregs and refuse everywhere in every way. Yes, Liz, that's exactly it. Do the gods have the right to make a soul the way it is and then deem it ugly? Notice how exactly that, and I agree with you, that's exactly one of the directions in which her line of thinking here goes. And notice, Liz, how that brings us right back to her accusation of the gods, right? It's exactly like the kind of thing. Remember how like pestilential the gods are to men, right? All those things that she was saying in her closing argument at the end of book one, it points us right back in that direction, right? So, Maureen, I am not at all saying that I think Orawal is correct about this. She finds this thought that some are predestined to be blessed and accepted and some are predestined to be dregs and refuse everywhere in every way. She finds this infinitely likely to be true in this moment. It doesn't necessarily mean that it is, right? I mean, what's... Orwell's still mid-process here, right? So let's keep going. But I wanted to just remember where she ended up here, because, again, super important. And in particular, I wanted to remember the obvious, as soon as we think about it, relevance to Psyche and Orwell and the jealousy situation. Okay, so let's keep going. About this time, there came, if you call it so, another dream. But it was not like a dream, for I went into my chamber an hour after noon, none of my women being there, and without lying down or even sitting down, walked straight into the vision by merely opening the door. She has described the uncertainty before of whether what she's seeing is a dream and questioning if it matters, whether it was a dream, a vision, or a thing that actually occurred, right? And now we have those lines much more thoroughly blurred as she's walking into her room and she walks straight into a vision. I found myself standing on the bank of a bright and great river, and on the further bank I saw a flock of sheep, I thought. Then I considered them more closely, and I saw that they were all rams, high as horses, mightily horned, and their fleeces such bright gold that I could not look steadily at them. There was deep blue sky above them, and the grass was a luminous green like emerald, and there was a pool of very dark shadow, clear-edged, under every tree. The air of that country was sweet as music. Now those, thought I, are the rams of the gods. If I can but steal one golden flock off their sides, I shall have beauty. Redival's ringlets were nothing to that wool. And in my vision, I was able to do what I had feared to do at the Shenet, for I went into the cold water, up to my knee, up to my belly, up to my neck, and then lost the bottom and swam and found the bottom again and came up out of the river into the pastures of the gods. And I walked forward over that holy turf with a good and glad heart. But all the golden rams came at me. They drew closer to one another as their onrush brought them closer to me, till it was a solid wall of living gold. And with terrible force, their curled horns struck me and knocked me flat, and their hoofs trampled me. They were not doing it in anger. They rushed over me in their joy. Perhaps they did not see me. Certainly I was nothing in their minds. I understood it well. They butted and trampled me because their gladness led them on. The divine nature wounds and perhaps destroys us merely by being what it is. We call it the wrath of the gods. As if the great cataract in Fars were angry with every fly it sweeps down in its green thunder. Okay. Oh, so much. So much here. Okay. let's go through this carefully. Now, first, hang on, no. First, one really small note. I couldn't decide if this was a mistake in my text. I copied this, and the text I'm using is from Apple Books, but if I can steal but one golden flock off their side, does it mean lock? It should be lock, right? Flock is the whole bunch of sheep, right? Lock of wool? It should be lock, right? It's an error in my text. I didn't notice it until I was reading it, and then I was like, what the heck? Anyway, that's going to bother me. Hang on. I'm going to fix it. It should be lock, right? Do you guys have lock in your texts? I mean, I don't want to make a mistake and assume it's an error just because, I mean, I'm like, maybe that's a usage that I'm not familiar with. But anyway, okay. You have flock also? Yeah, I tell you what. I'll do this instead. I will put flock and I'll put a little asterisk next to it to mark my uncertainty. You always got to be careful though. By the way, this is how one way that textual variants enter into manuscripts, right? You've got a scribe who's copying a text and they're like, he can't have meant that. He must have meant this. And they fix it. Right. And now you have variants. So either. So everybody says flock in their text. So either the original text is wrong or else there is an alternate meaning that I'm not familiar with, which I'm excited if it's true. Coarse tufts of wool or cotton used in bedding. Okay. It's just so strange because he uses the word flock. I saw a flock of sheep earlier on, like what I would expect the word flock to mean, right? Huh. Interesting. So flock and lock, it's a thing. Okay. See, that is a new one on me. Okay. I believe you. Anyway, okay, sorry. That was just a little issue I had. Okay. All right. Well, now let's go back. The first thing I want to consider. Look at the description. Let's start with the parentheses. The part which seems least significant, right? But it's significant to me because it's totally unnecessary, right? For some reason, she stops. So she describes the river, and she looks across the river and sees the sheep, the rams. And she describes the rams, right? And now, again, if we skip over the parentheses, we have her thoughts about the rams and her determination to steal a golden flock off their sides. And then her proceeding to do it, right? But we get that pause in the middle. So again, if we didn't have it, we would never know we didn't have it, right? And their fleece is such bright gold that I could not look steadily at them. Now those, thought I, are the rams of the gods, right? You'd never notice anything was missing there. So it's therefore interesting to me that she pauses for a moment and says, there was a deep blue sky above them. And the grass was luminous green like emerald, and there was a pool of very dark shadow, clear-edged, under every tree. The air of that country was sweet as music. Now, Leaf of Starlight, I agree. I was just going to ask, what does this remind us of? And what it reminds me of, for sure, is the description of the valley, the land of the gods, right? She has been in this kind of situation before, right? When she was standing and there was the stream and on the other side was Psyche and the Valley of the Gods up on, you know, that hidden valley on top of the the Grey Mountain, right? Except it's even, it's like that, but it's even more, right? So I think that one of the functions of that description is to sort of to make sure that we are thinking in those terms, that we are seeing the parallel. Once more, Orwell is standing on the edge of a river, looking out and seeing the land, the beautiful land of the gods, where the air is as sweet as music, where everything is clearer. Even the shadows are clear-edged under every tree. Right? Everything is clearly defined and real. Yes, Leif, thinking of The Great Divorce. Yeah, we won't get into it too much because not everyone's read The Great Divorce. But yes, it makes me think of that too a little bit. So this parenthesis gives us a fairly clear context of this land on the other side where the rams are, right? And it seems to therefore also, it seems to inform her own conclusion, right? Seeing them in that context, she says, now those are the rams of the gods. And what do we see of them? What do we notice about them? So let's go back a sentence. On the further bank, I saw a flock of sheep, I thought. Then I considered them more closely, and I saw that they were all rams, high as horses, mightily horned, and their fleeces such bright gold that I could not look steadily at them. They are like something that she's familiar with, right? They're like rams, but they're much more. And yes, those of you thinking of Jason and the Golden Fleece, I think that is certainly relevant. We've had enough references to, you know, the lies of the poets, right? To Greek myths and stories, that a connection like this to a Greek myth certainly seems worth acknowledging, right? How? What would you do with it? What does the golden fleece of Jason and the Argonauts seem to you to have to do with this, with these golden rams that she sees over there? It's a hard question. Let me be a little bit more specific. What is the role of the golden fleece in the story of Jason? Like, what's the point of it? Right? Like, what is it? What is its function in the story? Yeah, it's the pursuit of something unreachable, of something unreachable. Yes. It is the goal of the quest. It is the magical thing. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't have any practical function necessarily. It's the MacGuffin, sorta, pretty much. Yeah, but let's not just be diminutive. That's not the right. We may be diminutive as well. Let's not just diminish it, right? It is something extraordinary. It is something divine. It is something that is like a thing that you would see. I mean, like, these people would have seen many fleeces before, right? But this is a fleece unlike any fleece you have ever seen. This is a fleece of the ram of the gods, right? This is an object, like a mortal object, like something familiar and yet beyond, right? Whose beauty and whose value is beyond anything else of its kind, right? Of a completely different order. And its point is to be, yes, otherworldly, Jackie, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And you're right, Mrs. Manrique, there, it does have powers too. It does do things, but it's not, when I say it doesn't, it's not like, they're trying to accomplish that thing. And so they have to get that tool, right? It's not, the purpose is not to use it. The purpose is to have it, right? It's its value. Anyway, the otherworldly, glorious, beautiful, divine thing, which a human is going to transgress, and Jason does a whole bunch of transgressing in lots of different ways, right? That Jason, that a human being is going to transgress, is going to cross over and go where mortals have not gone before, and seize this divine thing and bring it back to the human world, right? There are several Greek myths that have that shape, right? And the Golden Fleece is certainly one of them. And again, note that in Orawal's vision here, you've got the golden rams with their multiple golden fleeces. Notice also first just kind of the amplification here, right? You know, Jason did a whole bunch for one golden fleece, right? This is a whole flock of them, right? Still on the hoof over there, right? I mean, the flock of the rams of the gods, this is order of magnitude greater than just, you know, any old golden fleece that Jason might go after. But that sense of transgression, especially given the whole mortal world, divine world with the river in between them thing, right, that is being set up here. Now, keep in mind where we just were. Fleeces of bright gold. Orawal over here, river in between, fleeces of bright gold on the other side. What should we be remembering? Just in the previous paragraph? What should we be remembering? The Psyche's hair, absolutely, yes. The smooth, rounded limbs, the little pink and white faces, and the hair like burnished gold. The burnished gold was the example of those fortunate ones, right? Like Psyche. Like Redival to some extent, but like Psyche much more. And so again, we have the situation of Orawal, river, land of the gods on the other side, which is where she saw Psyche before. Now, instead of Psyche, what she sees are the golden rams, right? With, you know, fleeces of burnished gold. So we already have a little bit of a connection there. And again, so to some extent, this kind of invokes her terrible sheer thought, right? That here she is, the ugly one, over on this side of the river. And there's the blessed, gorgeous ones on the other side of the river. And nothing she can do about it, right? But in her vision, what does she do? What's her immediate thought? Now, those are the rams of the gods. If I can steal but one golden flock off their sides, I shall have beauty. Redival's ringlets were nothing to that wool. She immediately, Jackie, I had not thought that having had a terrible sheer thought like a cliff in the previous paragraph, she's now having a terrible sheer thought of shearing the wool from the rams. I'm going to try to convince myself that that's a deliberate pun. He doesn't use the word shear, S-H-E-A-R, here, but but it's too delicious, isn't it? And it is terrifying. You're right. Trying to shear these ramps, and there is a sense, right? Like that's what she feels she's supposed to do. Like what she would have to do is to shear the rams, right? And it would be terrifying. Yeah. I kind of love that. Anyway, okay. But notice her own, she immediately makes the, just in case we missed it, right? She explicitly makes the connection. Redival's ringlets were nothing to that wool. That is, she explicitly makes the connection between the hair of beautiful women and the burnished gold fleece of these rams, right? So it's clear that we are supposed to be still remembering. This vision does come in the context of her thoughts about those who are predestined to be beautiful and those who are predestined to be ugly. But in her vision, she has a plan. She believes, what if this is a crossable frontier? If I can get over there and I can steal a golden flock off their sides, if I can capture some of their beauty, some of the divine beauty there from the divine realm. Again, very Jason the Golden Fleece-esque, right? If I can seize that divine thing for myself, then I will have beauty. It will make me beautiful as well. I'll be more beautiful than Redival. Right? So her thoughts, her vision is about transgression. And then what happens? In my vision, I was able to do what I had feared to do in the Shenet, for I went into the cold water up to my knee, up to my belly, up to my neck, and then lost the bottom and swam and found the bottom again and came up out of the river into the pasture of the gods. Why do we get all that about crossing the river? What should we be thinking about here, and how do we know we should be thinking about that? Why? Why is she making? Why do we get this whole progression? You remember what she's referring to, right? Yes, she tried and failed twice to enter a river like this. Agreed. Well, Maureen, we can connect this with baptism, and it has some things in common with that. But that's application. First, think about the connections inside the text, right? Like meeting Psyche, but more explicitly. She is explicitly alluding to an earlier passage here. And the passage is the one when she went to drown herself. Remember why she took off her girdle? She took off her belt and tied it around her ankles? Remember why she did that? And then, like, hopped, you know, a mixture of pathos and buffoonery, right? Do you remember why she explained why she did it that way? Yes. Yes, Maureen. So she wouldn't try to save herself. And as Curious Chance and Mighty Felix both say, because she knew she wouldn't have the courage to do, and she described it in exactly these terms. She did not believe that she would have the courage to walk out into the water, up to her knee, up to her belly, up to her neck, and keep going, and then drown. Because she doesn't think she can do that, she's going to just try to drown herself all at once by leaping off the bank with her feet tied so that she can't accidentally swim. And that's the passage that she's alluding to when she says, in my vision, I was able to do what I had feared to do at the Shenet. So the connection is explicitly to death. Going into the river, up to the cold water, up to the knee, the belly, the neck, and then losing the bottom and drowning the first time, right? This is a reference to not just death, but entering death, like, knowingly, deliberately. That's what she feared to do. She didn't think she could do it, right? But here, she does it. And here, she gets to the other side. And so I don't mean to discourage anybody who's remembering the other river. That's also true. The crossing over to Psyche, both when she succeeded by the strength of Psyche's hand to make it across the river, and when she failed to cross the river, when it was in spate during the storm and the destruction of the valley by the god. Wait a second. Do you remember the advice the god gave her? You know that line I refused to talk about at the time? When the god stopped her from killing herself? Remember what the god said? Do not do it. He said, do not do it about throwing yourself in. Twice he said it, right? Do not do it. Do not do it. Die before you die. Yeah, that's it, Jackie. Die before you die. Yeah. So, she enters into the river just as she sort of wanted to or felt like she should enter the river in order to kill herself. We see her, in order to get to the divine paddock on the other side, in order to get to the golden rams, she has to deliberately go through death. But here she does swim, and she comes up again on the other side. And is coming out a kind of rebirth, Mighty Felix? Yeah, kind of. She is born! She is born! Right? Yeah, it's a little bit like that. It's a little bit like that. Right. Curious Chance, that is an excellent question, to which I'm not sure we necessarily totally have an answer, but that is what gives her the courage to wade in now. Just the grasping at the divine. What was she doing before when she did not have the courage to do that at the Shenet? She was merely seeking death. Right? Here, she's not seeking death. She has that deathly experience, right? That death-like experience, but she's not trying to die. She's trying to get to the other side. She's trying to get to the, you know, the land of the gods and the golden rams over there. Yes, Mighty Felix, she wanted to stop being Unget, who, though pretty hideous, is divine as well, right? Now she wants divinity. So there are definite differences. There are definite differences here. Okay. And I walked forward over that holy turf with a good and glad heart, but all the golden rams came at me. Okay, there's several interesting. Let me just read the end again. But all the golden rams came at me. They drew closer to one another as their onrush brought them closer to me, till it was a solid wall of living gold. And with terrible force, their curled horns struck me and knocked me flat, and their hoofs trampled me. They were not doing it in anger. They rushed over me in their joy. Perhaps they did not see me. Certainly I was nothing in their minds. I understood it well. They butted and trampled me because their gladness led them on. The divine nature wounds and perhaps destroys us merely by being what it is. We call it the wrath of the gods, as if the great cataract in Fars were angry with every fly it sweeps down in its green thunder. Okay. Okay. So, oh, goodness, where to start? First of all, you'll know I'm taking a long time with this passage. Here's a little confession I'm going to make. You will notice there will be a bunch of passages in the last two chapters of this book that I will spend a lot of time with. Those are the ones I don't understand. So be patient with me, because I'm still working. I don't feel like I've ever really fully understood the Rams of the Gods, so I'm working through this. Okay. Yes, Leaf of Starlight. Let's start there. She's describing... So Leaf of Starlight says, This seems almost like a restating of the loving and the devouring are one idea, but framed through beauty instead. Yes, it is much like that. It is their gladness led them on. The divine nature wounds and perhaps destroys us merely by being what it is. Bright and beautiful and huge and strong and joyful. Yeah. Maybe the loving and the devouring are one. They can't help it. They can't help it, right? Now, there is one thing that she says here that I think is obviously incorrect. She says, they rushed over me in their joy. Perhaps they did not see me. I think it's clear that that's not true. Do you see why I say that? The rams aren't just... They're not just moving as a herd, and she happens to be in the way of the herd, and so gets trampled by, like, a couple of them. Right? They're converging on her. Right? I mean, she describes it that way. All the golden rams came at me. They drew closer to one another as their onrush brought them closer to me, till it was a solid wall of living gold. So it is clear that they are converging on her. They obviously see her, right? They obviously are seeking her out. And so, I also think there's another thing that she says. Right after that. Perhaps they did not see me. Certainly I was nothing in their minds. I don't think that's true. But let's hang on to that a second. Let's come back to that in a moment. First, let's try to understand what she's saying. And then we'll look at how she might be wrong. What she is saying, right? Is that she feels it to be something sort of impersonal, right? The thing that she's trying to emphasize is that they're not doing it in anger, right? With terrible force, their curled horns struck me and knocked me flat, and their hoofs trampled me. They were not doing it in anger. Right? She's like, this is not this divine force, the divine strength and glory and beauty of these golden rams is not seeking her out in order to destroy her. It's not angry at her, right? Even though it kind of seems like she's being targeted and crushed by this. What she is quick to emphasize, although she does definitely feel crushed, butted and trampled, perhaps wounded and perhaps destroyed, she compares herself to a fly caught in a great waterfall, right? And yet, her emphasis is this thing, like, we call it the wrath of the gods. But it's not the wrath of the gods, right? They're not angry. They're just being what they are. Their gladness led them on. Because the rams are so huge and so strong and so exuberant, they can't help but crush her. Because they're so huge and strong, just out of proportion with humanity, right? They can't help but crush her. I mean, that is if they, you know, approach her, they can't help but crush her, right? And they can't help but approach her because of their joy. They rushed over me in their joy. They butted and trampled me because their gladness led them on. It's what they do. So now, And again, this is why she says, like, it's so when someone is destroyed by what we call the wrath of the gods, it's not wrath. God isn't angry. Anyone in the waterfall is angry at the fly. It's just, it's what happens. Why does a fly get destroyed by the waterfall? Because the fly got too close to the waterfall. Waterfall didn't hunt it down, right? This is what happens. This is what happens when a fly approaches a waterfall. Like, it's inevitable. When the mortal and the divine mix, somebody's getting trampled. That's what's going to happen. Not because, necessarily, because the gods are angry at that person. In their joy, they would do it. This is, so back to two last things. Three last things. Let's see if I can remember all three. Coming back to what she's wrong about. Perhaps they did not see me. Certainly I was nothing in their minds. That's not true. It's clearly not true. She is something in their minds. She is, like, more correct than she knows about the inevitability of the crushing. Why did they crush her? What are they joyful about? What are they glad about? They're glad to see her. They're coming to her. Not out of anger. Not out of hatred. Out of love. Out of joy. Right? This terrifying herd of golden rams is responding to her crossing of the river like a, you know, like your dog responds when you get home from work. Right? That, I think, is what we're trying to understand here. Right? And yeah, I agree, Jackie. She's experienced very little of this kind of thing. When she sees, she perceives it clearly enough to understand that they're not angry at her. This is not wrath. It's joy. But it's almost like she's deflecting that. Like, it, perhaps they didn't see me. Certainly I was nothing in their minds. I think that's deflection. I think that she can see. She can clearly see their joy and their gladness. And I think that she can see that they're gladness and their joy are focused on her, and she's deflecting it because she doesn't understand it, because she's never experienced that, because she feels like that must not be right. But I think it clearly is. Now, back to the second thing I wanted to talk about, and that is the loving and the devouring are one. This is a very different perspective on that concept. But at the end of the day, it's not a totally different concept, right? The loving and the devouring are one. Before, that just seemed kind of horrible, right? That the shadow brute devouring the sacrifice and the son of Unget marrying the sacrifice, it was functionally the same thing. And when she, Orwell, was thinking about the loving and the devouring being one before, that was like an indictment of the love, if you see what I mean, right? Like, to be married to the god is just as bad as being devoured by the shadow brute. It's all pretty much the same thing, right? Yes, exactly. Before it seemed like the Shadow Brood, and now it seems like the God of the Mountain. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Now we see that, are the loving and the devouring the one? Yeah, in a sense. In a sense. but it looks very different. What's the kind of take-home message here? If Orwell's being taught a lesson, what is it? What is it, and how does it connect to the thoughts she was just having about being predestined to ugliness of body and soul? That's the third thing, the connection, which is explicitly made through Redivald's ringlets here, to physical beauty as well. Okay, so let's think about that a little more. Remember Psyche talking about the experience of coming into the hall of the gods, right? Coming into the house of the god on the mountain, her house, right? She's told. Her experience of the gap between the mortal and the divine, the shame that she felt about being mortal, right? And remember the sort of program of gradual induction into that world that the god of the mountain seemed to have in mind for Psyche, right? His saying that she could not see his face yet seemed to be part of that, right? And there was even the implication that there was also a long-term plan to bring Orwell in on this. But Orwell was a little further down the road, right? Where Psyche could see the house but was not allowed yet to see the god face to face, Orwell couldn't even see the house yet, or was given only one glimpse of the house. But remember Psyche saying that her hope, her trust, was that her husband would have mercy, and that Orwell would eventually be able to see the house, right? That he would make her able to do this. But on her own, as she was, she couldn't. And here's another sort of application. Remember her complaint against the gods. Why won't the gods talk to us? Why won't they appear to us and speak to us plainly, face to face? Well, here's one answer. The fly and the waterfall. Maybe that's why. Maybe, Orwell, if the gods acted how you are accusing them of not acting, maybe you would be swept away like the fly in the great cataract of farce. Maybe if you, in your mortal self, crossed over the river and entered the land under your own power and tried to seize the beauty of the gods for your own self, maybe that's not going to work out. Maybe that's not possible. Maybe there are good reasons why the gods don't do the things that Orwell accuses them of not doing. And remember, of course, one of the ironies there. What did she accuse them of? She said, "You only communicate with people how? In dreams and visions." Right? Like this, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Doc, the god spoke to Orwell. Hi, Doc, by the way. Glad you could make it live. The god spoke to Orwell twice without frying her. Sort of. I mean, yeah, she wasn't fried. Like, it wasn't the full-on fly in the cataract experience, right? But it was fairly terrifying. And, yeah. Yes. We'll come back to it. Yeah, exactly, Doc. Just because you're a Marshall amp, the god of rock and roll amplifiers, Doc is a pro on rock and roll amplifiers, doesn't mean you have to be turned up to 11 a la Spinal Tap. Yes, exactly. Exactly. yes. Okay, now, Sharon, thanks. Let's come back to point three, which is what does this have to do with pretty women? Okay, as you say, the Rams are not the gods. Correct. The Rams are not the gods. They are the Rams of the gods. They are like the beautiful women. Yes. They have beauty and glory of the gods, from the gods. They're part of the divine landscape here. They're not the gods themselves. They're part of this divine landscape. They are like the beauty that is within this divine landscape. And remember, it's because they are beauty. She believes, and she's probably not wrong about this, right? That if she can take one bit of their golden fleece for herself, that she will become beautiful. Their golden flocks are like the golden curls of Redival and of Psyche. And she believes that if she has one, then she'll be beautiful too. So there is very clear and explicit connection between beauty and these rams. And the beauty, remember, that thought she just had in the previous paragraph, is that this beauty is something that is in the gift of the gods. They give this beauty to some people and they don't give it to other people. And then she immediately has a vision of trying to seize it for herself. Which is also, in a sense, you could say, kind of what she was doing with her philosophizing. Trying to beautify herself. Right? There is a way of looking at this and saying what she is doing here is a version of what she was trying to do before. Trying to make her soul beautiful. Here now in this vision, but there are differences. Right? The differences are before she was trying, like, within the entirely mortal context to make herself beautiful by the exercise of her own mortal will and intellect, right? And that failed. But now she's going to leave the mortal world behind and she's going to cross over and transgress into the land of the gods, going through death in order to get there. But she's still trying to see some of that beauty for herself to make herself beautiful. And she fails. She does not get the fleece of the gods. What does she get instead? Instead of getting the one piece of the fleece of one of the rams, she gets all the rams. Right? They all come. The beauty and glory of the divine, like the beauty and the glory of the gods, the beauty and glory that is in the gift of the gods, crushes her. Joyfully, in gladness. She is wounded and destroyed. She's not given the beauty. She's crushed by it. And there's a way in which that's a kind of a picture in her mind of rejection, the kind of rejection she was just suspecting. That I just wasn't one of the lucky ones, that I was predestined for rejection. I've been given an ugly face and an ugly soul, and that means the gods have rejected me from before I was born. Right? And seeing her crushed by this beauty certainly, I think, recalls that. And yet, the devouring, the crushing, is also about love. Is it because she was spurned? Is she damaged here by being stranded? No, it's the opposite. What we get here is not a picture of the gods saying, sorry, Orwell, talk to the hand, right? I don't care about you. I've got all this beauty, right? I've got all of these good things that I could give, but I'm not giving any to you. Instead, the picture is of the pouring out of such abundance upon her that it crushes her. She doesn't just get a little bit of the fleece. She gets all the rams, right? In their gladness and joy. The loving and the devouring are one, but the devouring and the loving are one too. Right? So, is her intuition of a moment ago confirmed? It almost looks like it. And yet it's also reversed in a different way. But I think she still doesn't understand it. She talks about the divine nature wounding and destroying us merely by being what it is. Oh, wait. And what is it? Ungit. Notice how this is relevant to her, too. The loving and the devouring are always relevant to her, too. That's why she's Ungit, because everyone that she loves, she has devoured. And she sees that her love has always been a kind of devouring, and that she devours everybody that loves her and everybody that she comes in contact with. She is Ungit. So maybe her devouring is loving as well. Jackie, I know you have been remembering C.S. Lewis's Four Loves many, many times, and it's really hard because I totally agree with you. Like, I think that the connections you're making between the stuff that Lewis says in the Four Loves and the stuff he says here, I totally agree with you. I just don't want to talk about it because not everyone's read the Four Loves. So I don't want to necessarily go there. I want to stay within this text. But yes, yes, yes. Same thing with A Great Divorce. Yes, absolutely relevant in lots of ways, but we're not there right now. So I don't want to, I don't want to go there. All right. Yet they did not kill me. When they had gone over me, I lived and knew myself and presently could stand on my feet. Then I saw that there was another mortal woman with me in the field. She did not seem to see me. She was walking slowly, carefully, along the hedge which bordered that grassland, scanning it like a gleaner, picking something out of it. Then I saw what? The rams had left some of their golden wool on them as they raced past. This she was gleaning, handful after handful, a rich harvest. What I had sought in vain, by meeting the joyous and terrible brutes, she took at her leisure. She won without effort what utmost effort would not win for me. You hear the echo there? She won without effort what utmost effort would not win for me. Just like the pretty women and the ugly women, right? It's not fair. It's not fair. She wanted to get some of the wool, and she couldn't get any of it. She got trampled instead. But because she got trampled, they left all they as they raced past towards her to trample her, they left some of their wool on the hedge. And now this other woman just waltzes in, starts plucking the wool off the hedge. She won without effort, but utmost effort would not win for me. It's not fair. What I had sought in vain by meeting the joyous and terrible brutes, she took at her leisure. Brutes. Just in case you weren't making the connection between the devouring of the shadow brute and the trampling of the rams, we get them actually called brutes here. Right. And I agree, Leif, that line, when they had gone over me, I lived and knew myself. That's such a fascinating phrase, isn't it? That's more than just like, I was conscious, right? I mean, the literal meaning, I think, like on the literal level, what she's saying is, I was still alive and conscious, right? But of course, knowing herself has been something that Orwell has been very slowly coming to do over the course of this entire book, right? And when she knows herself, that is also when she perceives this other mortal woman in the field. So, yeah. Maureen, you're right. Orwell is always trying to get things by force. Yes. Yes. And not usually succeeding. I guess she gets her crown by force, in a sense, right? Yeah. Yeah, Emily, you're right. That is how her daddy did it. Right. Yes. She is like her father in that. Okay. We'll come back to this. Let's keep going for now. I now despaired of ever ceasing to be Unget. Though it was spring without, in me a winter, which I thought must be everlasting, locked up all my powers. It was as if I were dead already, but not as the god or Socrates bade me die. Yet all the time I was able to go about my work, doing and saying whatever was needful, and no one knew that there was anything amiss. Indeed, the dooms I gave, sitting on my judgment seat about this time, were thought to be even wiser and more just than before. It was work on which I spent much pains, and I know I did it well. But the prisoners and plaintiffs and witnesses and the rest seemed to me more like shadows than real men. I did not care a straw, though I still labored to discern who had a right to the little field, or who had stolen the cheeses. I had only one comfort left me. However I might have devoured Bardia, I had at least loved Psyche truly. Phew, that is a comfort to think about, isn't it? There, if nowhere else, I had the right of it, and the gods were in the wrong. And as a prisoner in a dungeon or a sick man on his bed makes much of any little shred of pleasure he still has, so I made much of this. And one day, when my work had been very wearisome, I took this book as soon as I was free and went out into the garden to comfort myself and gorge myself with comfort by reading over how I had cared for Psyche and taught her and tried to save her and wounded myself for her sake. Oof. Yeah. So about that, Orwell. Right? So we've been noticing that she's been avoiding the heck out of this topic, right? She has been coming to know herself better and better, right? She is coming to a clearer and clearer self-awareness. She had this massive and painful realization of the nature of her love for Bardia and her relationship with him over the years. You know, she even had a real, that like more minor realization about her relationship with Redival. So, you know, all of this, right, the surgery that has been done to her, but in all of this, she's been avoiding the one thing, and we've seen it several times, right? Sometimes painfully. And there have been moments when she's almost like she's flirted with the reality of it, right? With the applicability of these things, that she is Unget, and that she was Unget to Psyche too, or tried to be Unget to Psyche too, right? And this second paragraph here is the last time we see Orwell in this deep, in the kind of self-deception that we have seen her be in so far, right? Yes, Curious Chance, you're right. She gorges herself with comfort. Very conspicuous. The devouring imagery again. Like the spider at the middle of the web, right? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the final accusation she has against the gods. She feels she still holds on to the idea that she was justified in how she acted towards Psyche, that she, how I had cared for Psyche and taught her and tried to save her and wounded myself for her sake. And she was done wrong by the gods and by Psyche. Right? But Jackrabbit, you're right. And I don't want to skip over. There's a reason, of course, why she talks about her work as queen sitting in judgment here. We are reminded that she is a judge. And that one of her jobs is giving dooms, right? That she is trying to, she's spending much pains on her work, trying to discern wisdom and justice. She doesn't actually care about who has a right to that little field and who stole the cheeses. She doesn't actually care. Right? But this work is important and she takes it seriously. But she's distanced from it. So distanced that the prisoners and plaintiffs and witnesses and the rest now seem to me more like shadows than real men. So we get this image of the queen sitting on her judgment seat in a courtroom full of shadows. And she is the one who is sorting and discerning and decreeing dooms. Right? Cal Elros, that's really cool. Cal Elros wants to reverse the sentence. He's like, the sentence in the middle works quite well if you reverse it. The second sentence of the second paragraph there. However I might have loved Bardia, I had at least devoured Psyche, truly. The loving and the devouring are one, Cal Elros. It does suggest maybe you can do that. Anyway, yeah, Doc, I do think we're seeing her world becoming more insubstantial as the divine world becomes more real. Orawal could see Psyche's apotheosis. Like, she was becoming more and more like a goddess and less like a human. She was taller. She was stronger. She was so bright-faced, remember? There was more of divinity of her and less of mortal woman of her. Certainly, since Orwell had last seen her, right? I don't think that that's necessarily what's being... I don't think that Orwell, the queen herself... And yet, notice, her dooms were thought to be wiser and more just than before. Inasmuch as she is sitting in judgment and attempting to do justice wisely, she's doing it better and more like the gods, perhaps, right? So, yeah, I hadn't thought about it in those terms, Doc, but now that you say that, I think that's exactly right. I think we do see her. She crossed over the river, right? She's now twice tried to die before she dies, right? What was the first way? Because the throwing yourself in the river doesn't count. Oh, yeah, sorry. By the Socrates method, right? by dying to self in the philosophical way. Right. So remember, that was her immediate application. Like when the god said, die before you die, she's like, oh, yeah, like Socrates was right. Right. He's talking just like Socrates. So first is she tried to die before she died in the philosophic sense. Right. With the application of philosophy, that didn't pan out because, of course, the problem was it didn't actually, like, she didn't die enough. Right. She would try to put to death her own passions, her own desires, her own sinful impulses. Right. And it just kept popping up again. Right. Those things wouldn't die. Right. They kept coming back. That was awkward. So that was her first attempt to die before she died and didn't work. And her second attempt was the crossing of the river in her vision. Right. She crossed over the river and into the land of the gods, crossing from through death from mortal into the divine world. And she encountered the beauty and the joy of the gods, and it trampled her. It still didn't seem to. On the one hand, it didn't seem to work. But on the other hand, Doc, I wonder, I suspect that perhaps she is, it did work a little bit, right? That she had her efforts to die before, maybe she died a little bit, right? That seems a little odd to say, but yes, I like that. The real world concerns of these people, and even the people themselves, are more distant from her. What followed was certainly a vision and no dream, for it came upon me before I had sat down or unrolled the book. So remember, she's gone into the garden with her book in order to gorge herself on comfort of how much and how well she loved Psyche and totally didn't devour her at all, right? And once again, vision comes upon her while she's still standing up and walking around. So she takes her book, the book that she wrote, book one, we're talking about, right? She takes book one into the garden and suddenly finds herself in a vision. She walked into the vision with my bodily eyes wide open. I was walking over burning sands, carrying an empty bowl. Notice the immediate contrast between the garden that she was going into and the burning desert that she finds herself in her vision instead. So the garden turns out in her vision to be a burning waste desert, and her book in her hands turns out to be an empty bowl in her vision now. I knew well what I had to do. I must find the spring that rises from the river that flows in the deadlands and fill it with the water of death and bring it back without spilling a drop and give it to Unget. For in this vision, it was not I who was Unget. I was Unget's slave or prisoner, and if I did all the tasks she set me, perhaps she would let me go free. So I walked in the dry sand up to my ankles, white with sand to my middle, my throat rough with sand, unmitigated noon above me, and the sun so high that I had no shadow. Stop. Do you notice what he did there? Do you see it? Do you see it? Pay attention now. Stop making puns over there, folks, and pay attention. This is important. What did he just do? So I walked in the dry sand up to my ankles, white with sand to my middle, my throat rough with sand. Just like the river, yeah. Up to her ankles, up to her belly, up to her neck, right? So she is explicitly connecting the desert to the river of death that she passed through that she didn't dare to pass through before, that she did dare in her last vision to pass through in order to get to the glorious land of the gods with the golden rams. Right? And now she is going through the burning sands up to her ankles, up to her belly, up to, you know, up to her middle, up to her throat, in order to fill her empty bowl with water, with the water of death. So we got the water of death explicitly, but it's in a different role. She's seeking the water. She's not passing through the water of death. She's seeking the water of death. She has been trying to figure out how to die before she dies, right? So she's seeking the water of death. But as she does so, she does it again. She passes through. The desert itself is like that death water experience, right? So she herself is dying as she seeks death. That those gradual gradients of death. And what's she going to do? What's she going to do with the water of death when she gets it? She's going to give it to Unget. That's her task. Her task is to take the water of death and not to drink it herself, but to give it to Unget, so that Unget can receive the waters of death. Remember how she wanted to die in order to stop being Unget? All these things are all tied together here. Okay, let's keep going. Unmitigated noon above me, and the sun so high that I had no shadow. Unlike the shadows of the trees, as several of you are pointing to, right? Okay. And I longed for the water of death, for however bitter it was, it must surely be cold, coming from the sunless country. I walked for 100 years. But at last the desert ended at the foot of some great mountains, crags and pinnacles and rotting cliffs that no one could climb. They were probably sheer and a little bit terrifying, I bet you. Rocks were loosened and fell from the heights all the time, their booming and clanging as they bounced from one jag to another, and the thud when they fell on the sand were the only sounds there. Kind of terrifying. Looking at the waste of rock, I first thought it empty, and that what flickered over its hot surface was the shadow of clouds, but there were no clouds. Then I saw what it really was. Those mountains were alive with innumerable serpents and scorpions that scuttled and slithered over them continually. The place was a huge torture chamber, but the instruments were all living. And I knew that the well I was looking for rose in the very heart of these mountains. I can never get up, said I. This is impossible. She can't climb up. She's been walking through the desert already for 100 years, this desert of death, in order to seek the waters of death. She can't climb up the heights. And the heights are falling down on her all the time. Yes, JJ, I agree. I love the alliteration there. Serpents and scorpions that scuttled and slithered. Yes, it's delightful. Yes, Jackie, you're right. All the creepy, crawly things that Psyche loved. She had the unchanciest love for these things. She loved snakes and scorpions and toads, remember? I'm so glad you remembered that, Jackie. I wasn't remembering that. Yeah, yeah. A huge torture chamber. But Jackie, you do get the impression that if Psyche were there, she'd look at it quite differently, don't you think? Right? Yes, Ambrosius, I think that's exactly right. What happened the first time she tried to die before she died? It was impossible. She couldn't do it. She tried. She really tried. To die to herself. To put to death her own desires. To die in that Socratic sense. You know, in Socrates' sense. And it was impossible. And exactly that same impossibility is what she's in. This is not, she can't climb. And even if she could climb it, the rocks are all falling down on her head. And even if the rocks weren't falling down on her head and she could climb it, the whole thing is swarming with serpents and scorpions. It's a torture chamber with living torture instruments who will doubtless sting and bite her very joyfully, right? I can never get up. I sat upon the sand, gazing up at them, till I felt as if the flesh would be burned off my bones. Then at last there came a shadow. Oh, mercy of the gods! Could it be a cloud? I looked up at the sky and was nearly blinded, for the sun was still straight above my head. I had come, it seemed, into that country where the day never passes. Remember what she's referring to? Yet the days passed. Yet the days passed. The human heart has the capacity for experiencing an unlimited amount of suffering, she said. But there is one mercy, is that the days still pass. Unless, remember, she had that one horrifying passing thought, there be a place in the Deadlands where the days don't pass. That would be the greatest torture chamber of all, where everything is stagnant. The sun burning down from overhead, like the light that is shown onto her life by her book, right? Remember the way that she felt exposed, like her body was being cut open and exposed to the light, right? The unrelenting view of the divine vision gazing down upon the reality. No shadow to hide in. Nothing with which you can conceal or shade yourself from the view of that eye, right? Of that sight looking down on you. And now it's like it's burning her away. This scalding light, the scalding clarity upon herself. And it's also that horrible place in the Deadlands where the days don't pass, where you can't even just endure and let it go by, because it doesn't go by. It never stops. Yeah, like the voice of the god being compared to the light, like the lightning that stays. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. It's like she's under that light constantly, right? Yet at last, though the terrible light seemed to bore through my eyeballs into my brain, I saw something, black against the blue, but far too small for a cloud. Then by its circlings, I knew it to be a bird. Then it wheeled and came lower, and at last was plainly an eagle, but an eagle from the gods, far greater than those of the highlands and fars. It lighted on the sand and looked at me. Its face was a little like the old priest's, but it was not he. It was a divine creature. Yeah, so the connection. Again, this is another. She's just like we got the reference to Redival's curls, just in case we failed to make the connection between the golden rams and the beautiful women in the previous passage. So here, just in case we forget the bird mask, right? And the whole bird and egg hatching motif around the worship of Unget, we're reminded of that here, right? An eagle descends to her, and its face is a little bit like the old priest's, but it's not him. It's not actually him. It was a divine creature. You see the implication of that? One of the implications, of course, there is a logical extension of the idea its face was a little like the old priest's. One extension of that is as somebody was saying, who was saying this, that it's that the priest was not a divine creature. Right? Yeah. Yeah. To say one obvious corollary to that statement, its face was a little like the old priest's, is, but it's also unlike the old priest's. Right? The old priest was not just a picture of the divine. There's a lot of unlikeness between the old priest and the divine. But of course, the other corollary is that if it's the face of this eagle is a little like the old priest's, then the old priest's face was a little like this eagle, right? There is a connection. There is a likeness, at least a little likeness, between them. And the fact of this divine creature appearing in the form of an eagle, in the form of this bird, does help, if not to, I wouldn't go so far as to saying that it like justifies the bird thing, right? The bird rituals, the bird symbolism of the worship of Unget in Gloam. But it does suggest that they're like at least a little bit onto something here, right? Now, I agree. Yeah, exactly, JJ. It's like the old priest had at least some truth, but not necessarily the complete truth. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, Ambrosius, I agree. Ambrosius says, the temple prostitutes were supposed to represent Unget's beauty to the people, but their beauty was painted on and tarnished by their ill use. The priest dressed in such a way to convey something about the gods to the people too, but he also wore a weak shadow. He also was a weak shadow and not the real thing. Yes. Yes, exactly. But I also love the other... somebody else. Yes, Mighty Felix. It's the old priest that the eagle reminds her of, not Arnhem, her friend, right? Arnhem doesn't look much at all like this eagle. Just like there's no comfort in the Greek painted Unget statue, right? I think that's not a coincidence. Yeah. And Jack Rabbit, you're right, this bird has a face. Which means, by implication, the old priest almost had one too. Or at least something that was like a face, right? Yes, Maureen, you are right to remember that Psyche wondered if, when he wore the mask, the bird mask, the old priest, if he became the god in some sense. Yeah. Yeah, that was a question of Psyche's. Yes. Curious Chance, I think you're absolutely right to be thinking in those terms. Okay. I'm going to try to do a 30-second version of this. What Curious Chance said was, types and shadows, but now we're in a land with no shadows. It is too much. Let me sum up. A shadow, the idea of shadows, this is a sort of a Platonic idea, right? That many there are things in the real world which are but shadows of things in the divine world. They're like them. They point to them, but they aren't them, right? And she is, but she is in her vision. There are no shadows. She casts no shadow. There's nothing but light and nowhere to hide from it. She is crossing over into the divine world where there are no shadows. So do I think that you're curious? I think you're exactly right that C.S. Lewis is playing on that idea. One of the consequences of going into the of crossing into the divine realm from the mortal world is that there are no shadows. And if you're reading Plato, that sounds like a good thing, doesn't it? right? Plato's like, the real things are over there in the divine world, but here in the mortal world, it's just shadows, right? It's just shadows. So, boy, to exchange shadows for the real thing sounds like a treat, doesn't it? Right? That's the real business, right? That would be awesome. Well, unless it wouldn't, right? Unless it wouldn't. Unless when you got into that, maybe you would wish for some shadows when you got there, right? What if being in a world with no shadows also means functionally being under the glaring sun right over your head all the time and you can't hide from it and everything is revealed, right? Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So there we go. I did the allegory of the cave in like less than 2 minutes, so that was pretty good. There's a lot more we could say about that. But yes, I do think that Lewis is playing on that. And if you don't know Plato well enough to get the full implications, don't worry about it. That's like a bonus. Just like some of his Bible references are, as I was saying last time, are kind of a bonus, right? Like we can understand what is going on within this story without them, though he kind of puts them out there for application. I kind of think some of the Platonic stuff, some of the... I believe that two things that you can do with the end of Till We Have Faces. Among the things that you can do with the end of Till We Have Faces include such diverse elements as applying it to Christian theology and, you know, New Testament teaching, and using it to think about and even evaluate Greek philosophy. Tomas, yes. Yes, Tomas says, then the shadow brute was just a poor reflection on earth of the real God. Uh-huh. And there are no shadows here. Just, you know what there aren't also here? It's, remember how dark it was in Psyche's bedchamber where light was not allowed to come? Right. And now Orawal finds herself in the opposite environment. All light, no shadow. Right. And it's killing her. Yes. The shadow brute and the beautiful god, the son of Unget, the beautiful god of the mountain. Perhaps. How could they both be the same? Right, it must be one or the other. Notice how, and Tomas is why, that's why I love that comment. Notice how we're beginning to see. He's beginning to show us how they can both be true. Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Okay. But I'm going to stop because it's late. All right, hang on. Let me peek. Yep. Let's stop. Because next we're coming right to the place. She is in the middle of this labor trial, right? The task she has to perform is to take her empty bowl, go across this desert for 100 years, go up this mountain through the snakes and scorpions, which is impossible, get the water from the river that flows from the deadlands that she can't get to, bring it back out, not spill a single drop of the water, and bring it to Unget. Right? Okay, so she never finishes this task. She knows this is her task. And if she does this, Unget might set her free. She's a slave of Unget right now. But if she completes the task, she might be set free. But we have reached the point where it immediately shifts to a courtroom where she's going to suddenly find that she is in the dock, right? That she's in a courtroom. So join us next week when Orwell finds herself in a courtroom. So we did get through, well, I say we get through the two trials, the trials of the Golden Fleece and the trial of the Waters of Death in the Bowl, except Orwell never finishes the second one. But that's not our fault. Yeah. All right. There we are. Next week, we will do the Trial of the Gods, where Orwell gets her day in court, where she finally gets to stand, gets to be on the stand and deliver her accusation against the gods, and to gorge herself in full on the comfort that is to be found in her book and all of the truth about how well she loved Psyche. Won't that be fun? We'll talk about that next week. All right? Exactly. I agree, JJ. It will certainly will be refreshing to see the gods held accountable for their failings. Totally agree. All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, everybody. See you guys next week. Good night now.